This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, August 13th. I'm Laura Flanders. Coming up, an eyewitness report from Jerusalem, where the weekend has seen more violence and growing protests. The American Corrections Association holds its annual convention in Philadelphia, and hundreds of people are missing in Angola after a mine attack on a railway. But first, these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two foreign journalists and 15 peaceful protesters went before a federal court for trespassing on the Navy's missile defense test. Laura Houther reports from Los Angeles.
15 Greenpeace activists and two foreign journalists involved in a protest against the Star Wars program are facing charges of conspiracy to violate a safety zone, a felony that carries a maximum sentence of more than 11 years in prison and fines up to $505,000. The activists delayed the launching of an anti-missile defense test at Vandenberg Air Force Base near Lompoc, California, by riding inflatable rafts into the test site safety zone. Katja Komisarek, the defendant's lawyer, said this is the first time nonviolent protesters have been charged with a felony. In previous cases, protesters have only been charged with misdemeanor trespassing, which carries a maximum sentence of 6 months. The group will be arraigned today in Los Angeles federal court. This is Laura Hawther in Los Angeles for Free Speech Radio News.
Another Supreme Court justice is being asked to remove himself from an upcoming attempt to stay an execution scheduled for Wednesday. Mary O'Grady reports on the Texas execution.
Napoleon Beasley, a 25-year-old African-American man, is scheduled for execution by the state of Texas on August 15th. Beasley's lawyers have asked for clemency from the State Board of Pardons and Paroles. They point out that at the time of Beasley's murder of John Ludig in Tyler, Texas, Beasley was a 17-year-old star athlete and president of his high school class with no previous police record. They are also asking the U.S. Supreme Court to step in to halt the execution. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has recused himself from the case because the murder victim's son, federal judge Michael Ludig, was his law clerk and remains a personal friend. Beasley's attorney, Walter C. Long, is also asking that Justice Clarence Thomas recuse himself from Beasley's case. He cites newspaper articles describing Beasley's victim's son as a key advisor to Thomas during Thomas's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. In Austin, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mary O'Grady.
Worldwide demonstrations will change the way the World Bank does business in the near future. Ellen Ratner explains how from D.C.
The World Bank and International Monetary Fund have decided to cut their annual meetings down to just 2 days in the face of expected protests. According to Jennifer Carr of the Institute for Policy Studies, shortened meetings represent a pre-protest victory for anti-globalization forces.
It's definitely good that they can't just proceed with business as usual. And as far as I'm concerned, if their business as usual is disrupted, that's fine.
According to the World Bank, the meetings were shortened due to the expectation of widespread violence, which the city government believes will be of a scope never seen before in the nation's capital. Thousands of extra police officers and stepped-up Secret Service coverage is expected for the meetings taking place the weekend of September 29th and 30th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ellen Ratner in Washington, D.C.
Florida Governor Jeb Bush said eliminating affirmative action in the state would not hurt minority enrollment in Florida's colleges and universities. Nell Abram reports that may not be true of the state's most prestigious university.
This year's freshman class at the University of Florida will be its whitest in years. The black student enrollment in the freshman class at the University of Florida is expected to be down by nearly half as a result of Governor Jeb Bush's ban on racial preferences in public university admissions. Blacks represented nearly 12% of the freshman class last year, but the class starting this month will be only 6 to 7% black. Minority enrollment at the state's 10 other universities appears to be unaffected. But the University of Florida is one of the nation's most academically prestigious and competitive universities. In every other state where racial preferences were eliminated, the elite schools suffered the quickest and sharpest declines in minority enrollment. I'm Nell Abram in Tampa for Free Speech Radio News.
And finally, Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman was physically shoved by WBAI's interim station manager, Utrice Lead. According to sources inside WBAI, Goodman saw station staffers going through the personal belongings of fired and banned program director Bernard White on Friday and took a picture of what she saw. Lead then grabbed the camera and walked away. When Goodman followed Leed and asked for her camera, Leed said she would develop the film herself, shoved Goodman out of her way, went into the station manager's office and shut the door. When asked to confirm or deny the story, Leed responded, quote, "Whatever your understanding is, it will have to be your understanding." I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Palestinians held a general strike Monday, shutting shops and government offices to protest Israel's takeover of their unofficial headquarters in Arab East Jerusalem. Outside the building known as Orient House, Israeli police scuffled with dozens of demonstrators who tried to raise a Palestinian flag. Raphael Kraft was there for Free Speech Radio News.
You just brutalized my daughter, and I'm wondering why. Why? Why did you beat my daughter? What do you feel when you do that?
This American peace activist talking to a female Israeli soldier exemplifies the tone of the peaceful demonstration that was held by more than 100 Palestinians and international peace activists in the vicinity of Orient House in East Jerusalem.
You are fled from our pictures. Let the people see what you're doing there.
The blocks around Orient House and the eight other Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem occupied by Israelis since Friday have been sealed off to prevent either journalists, demonstrators or Palestinians working in the area from entering the neighborhood. A heavy military and police presence in the area is dissuading Palestinians from going down in the streets. 500 Israeli paratroopers have been stationed in the Novotel Hotel in the vicinity of Orient House. Yet, a number of Palestinians were here, like Fatma Muhammad, a Palestinian resident from East Jerusalem.
People want to be involved, but they are not allowed. Nobody can come into Jerusalem. It's sealed. You can't come from Beit Hanina, you can't come from Ramallah, from Kalandia. It's sealed. They dug ditches, not to allow cars or people to cross. How can people come and support the Jerusalemite people? Young men, if they come, they are arrested. Their ID cards are confiscated. They are put in jail. The Orient House was the only center that defended them. If they are now in jail, who's going to defend them? Who's going to appoint a lawyer for them?
Among other Palestinian officials present in the demonstration is Hanan Ashrawi. The Jerusalem representative in the Palestinian Legislative Council reacts after she has been threatened yesterday by Jerusalem head of police to have her liberty of movement limited in the Holy City.
I think this is a clear indication of their political and legal and moral bankruptcy. They obviously are floundering. How can they prevent a person who was elected in Jerusalem to represent the Palestinian Jerusalemites from entering her own city? I know they're preventing non-Jerusalemites from coming to Jerusalem. Palestinians, Christians and Muslims are banned. But to ban also members of the parliament, the representatives of the people from their own city, I mean, this is the utmost of the absurd. And it tells you that they have no awareness whatsoever of what they're doing. They're merely trying to escalate and to threaten and to intimidate, and it won't succeed. I am here and I will continue to come back here, and I will be in Jerusalem. It's my city, not theirs.
After 2 hours, a Palestinian youth started to wave a Palestinian flag in front of the police and soldiers. The response was immediate. Palestinian political and cultural institutions had called for a general strike today in Jerusalem and the occupied territories to protest against Israeli occupation of their institutions in Jerusalem. 2,000 people demonstrated in Nablus, 1,500 in Hebron, chanting, "Jerusalem is ours." After several hours of symbolic and peaceful presence in front of Orient House, the police managed to scatter the demonstration, violently arresting 3 internationals and 4 Palestinians. Tomorrow evening, another demonstration will be held in front of Orient House. Palestinians are expected in a greater number, as well as Israeli radical peace activists. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in East Jerusalem.
Shall overcome someday.
The number of inmates in state prisons fell 0.5% in the second half of last year, according to a report from the Justice Department. As it has every year since 1972, the overall prison population grew. The total in both state and federal prisons now stands at 1.3 million. The female prison population has doubled in just the last 10 years. But the first slight decline since the so-called prison boom took off 3 decades ago has some in the private prison industry worried. Could the rate of growth of the prison population be flattening out? What would that mean for profits? The numbers are out just in time for the American Correctional Association's 131st Annual Congress, which is being held in Philadelphia this week. The ACA, a professional association representing all facets of prison systems, has proudly led and championed the corrections field for 130 years. This week, they are holding a trade show with over 600 booths and a series of workshops on such topics as the meaning of the death penalty, babies behind bars, budget reductions, and reintegration. A coalition of groups against the death penalty and the growing prison industry complex have joined them in Philadelphia. Miranda Kennedy brings us the first in a series of reports. It's a
At the American Correctional Association's officious general session this morning, the organization honored past and current officials in a joint honor guard ceremony representing 4 correctional institutions. Thomas Costello, Commissioner of Prisons for the Pennsylvania Prison System, extended a welcome on behalf of the city of Philadelphia, which, he pointed out, gave the U.S. the Declaration of Independence, as well as the country's first prison reform organization.
During your visit here, I hope you will visit the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall. About a mile to the west is Eastern State Penitentiary, where corrections was born 30 years later. Independence Hall and Eastern State, they are not polar opposites. They are both in their time expressions of hope and confidence that a free people could create humane institutions that would better the social condition.
Ed Koch, former 3-term mayor of New York City and former judge on the TV show The People's Court, was the keynote speaker at this morning's forum. He told the audience that he increased the number of prisons and length of jail terms as a New York congressman and mayor.
People talk about a reduction in crime. And why did it happen? And there are lots of reasons why it happened. And one of the reasons is mandatory sentencing. People who commit major crimes have to be in jail and for lengthy periods of time, and the judges were not being tough enough. And so mandatory sentences came into vogue, that the power on sentencing was taken from the judges.
But Koch also admitted that the mandatory sentencing system is one flawed aspect of the correction system in this country. Koch has proposed prison reform legislation in the New York Assembly, which aims to help reintegrating former prisoners back into society. This weekend, at the alternative conference to the ACA, the Counter the American Correctional Association conference, activists held workshops and meetings that addressed community organizing against prisons, alternatives to the death penalty, changing corporations that profit from prisons, and medical neglect in the prison health system. Jeff Garris of the Pennsylvania Abolitionists spoke about a direct action campaign against one of the pharmaceutical companies which had planned to attend the trade show of the ACA this week. Abbott Pharmaceuticals sells sodium thiopental, one of 3 chemicals used in lethal injection.
As a part of the healthcare industry, it's hypocritical and unethical for Abbott Laboratories to continue to sell sodium thiopental to those who they know are using it in a procedure that results in death. Based on Abbott's consistent participation in ACA trade shows, Pennsylvania decided that the ACA conference in Philadelphia this summer provided a prime opportunity to stop Abbott from profiting from death. Abbott opted to stay out of this year's trade show.
Those opposed to the ACA call it an umbrella group that profits from America's unjust prison system, from prison HMOs that are often sued for medical neglect to manufacturers of lethal injection drugs. The Counter the ACA conference this weekend seems to have successfully put the association on the defensive. They released a statement asserting that while they are not made up of offenders, they care for offenders and their families, and emphasizing the educational rather than the trade show aspects of their events this week. The Stop ACA Coalition will hold rallies against the prison industry, the death penalty, and the prison healthcare system this week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Philadelphia.
Hundreds of people are still missing in Angola after an attack on a train in which more than 90 people are reported to have died. The train detonated an anti-tank mine which had been placed on the track, and armed men attacked the passengers who survived the explosion. The attack comes after 3 months in which the rebel group UNITA has conducted a number of high-profile assaults in areas close to the capital. Reporting from Luanda is Rupert Cook.
Hundreds of people remain missing in Angola after the suspected rebel attack Friday on a train some 150 kilometers southeast of the capital, Luanda. The train detonated a landmine, which was placed on the track. Armed men then attacked those passengers who survived the explosion and the ensuing blaze from the train's burning fuel tank. It thought that the attack was the work of the rebel group UNITA, which in the last few months has conducted a number of high-profile assaults on areas close to the capital, aimed at causing maximum disruption. In Friday's attack, at least 90 people were killed and over 150 injured, with hundreds still unaccounted for. It's not known if the missing were abducted by UNITA forces, have fled into the bush, or whether their bodies are still to be recovered from the burnt-out train. Overland travel in Angola between the country's towns and cities is notoriously hazardous, with the constant threat of UNITA ambush. The more than 25-year-old civil conflict has forced millions of Angolans to seek sanctuary in government-controlled urban areas, dependent upon support from international relief and humanitarian agencies. Despite the Angolan government's frequent claims that the war is almost won and UNITA a spent force, the last few months have seen a series of spectacular rebel raids on areas previously considered secure. Friday's train attack fits into UNITA's new military strategy, which concentrates on lightning guerrilla assaults into the government's heartland, thus maximizing publicity for the rebel group and embarrassment for the government. This latest incident coincides with a visit to Angola by an American delegation which is trying to assess whether conditions are right for a general election which has tentatively been scheduled for next year. Although there are US government restrictions on official contacts and aid destined for the Angolan government, there is a large American commercial and corporate presence in Angola, mainly thanks to the country's status as an increasingly major producer and exporter of oil to the United States. Despite international sanctions, the rebel group UNITA is still estimated to be earning $100 million a year from illegal diamond sales. Angola is one of the world's poorest countries, and its life expectancy is among the lowest on the African continent. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook, in Luanda, Angola.
Around 3,000 people gathered in south-central France Sunday when an ultimatum to the French government to destroy all GMO crops expired. The demonstration was also in support of producers of ewe's milk who have been heavily hit by American trade sanctions against Roquefort cheese and several other products, that in response to a European ban on U.S. exports of beef treated with hormones. Sunday's protest against the use of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, took place on the second anniversary of the dismantling of the McDonald's outlet in Millau, an event that had a profound impact on French public opinion, 65% of which is against globalization. It also propelled the Radical Farmers Union, the Confederation Paysanne, to central stage. Sunday's demonstration was called by the Union of Roquefort Cheese Producers, labor unions, and the anti-globalization movement ATTAC. Sputnik Kalambi reports.
The Mio brass band out in force as a cloudless blue sky looks down on hundreds of anti-globalization protesters gathered in front of the McDonald's in Mio. There were 300 of them on August 12, 1999, when the McDonald's was dismantled, an act that led to the trial of José Bové and his comrades on June 30th, a year later. 50,000 people descended on Mio that day, rebaptized Seattle-sur-Tarn, after the river that runs through Mio.
but the spirit of Seattle, Gothenburg, and Genoa is very much there, and the show of force significant given that August is a dead month in France. Farmers and students, young and old, people from all walks of life applaud as dozens of tractors led by the Confédération Paysanne's firebrand spokesman, José Beauvais, roll down in front of the McDonald's that looks desolate in the bright sunshine.
We are here today to say that we don't agree with the decision of WTO to take a sentence against Europe because Europe doesn't want to import beef treated with hormone. And we are here to say that we don't agree with the 100% tax that United States put on the 60 European products. And since 2 years, this is going on and nothing has changed. So we are here to make pressure against the French government and against the Europe.
The McDonald's will remain sealed off until the French government responds adequately. Alain Soulier is the spokesman of the Union of Producers of Ewe's Milk, from which the famous Roquefort cheese is made.
Le gouvernement français, sur ce problème, comme sur beaucoup d'autres,
on this issue, as on many others, the French government says, we understand you, your right to act, etc., but there's nothing we can do. This is what all Western governments say, that we can do nothing. This is how the market and global trade work. We are powerless against multinationals. This is what we accuse these politicians of, that they have bowed down to the multinationals.
The response to Sunday's action has been immediate. Both EU Trade Commissioner Pascal Lamy and the French Agriculture Minister have agreed to meet with farmers' representatives this week. The US sanctions have been in place 2 years, though, and Europe has been deaf and blind to the consequences, says Alain Soulier.
Producers of ewe's milk lose around 6,000 francs a year. This might seem like a little, but you know, we don't earn that much, and 6,000 francs is about a month's salary for the average farmer. There has been no compensation, either from the French government or Europe.
Genoa is on everybody's minds. A minute's silence in memory of Carlo Giuliani, murdered in Genoa by Italian police, and a musical send-off as the crossroads in front of the Mio McDonald's is renamed Place Carlo Giuliani. Genoa was a turning point, says 65-year-old Guy Holstein, who heads the attack committee in Mio. Everybody knows now that the state is prepared to use force.
There comes a moment when breaking the law becomes an act of self-defense. This is how I think we should see it. We cannot abide by a legal system that goes against the principles of democracy. If the law does not respect these principles that govern our society, well, then we must work against the law.
José Beauvais and the Confédération Paysanne have called for civil disobedience if the French government refuses to destroy GMO crops planted in open fields. The deadline expired Sunday, and it looks as if Beauvais' troops will take matters into their own hands.
So far, the French government, they only having discussion. They say, we have to discuss about these GMOs in the open field. So we say, that's not the problem. We want you to destroy, and we discuss after. So for the moment, they didn't change anything.
So you maintain your call for civil disobedience, and the destruction will start when?
The destruction are going to begin this week, and they're going to be finished at the end of the month.
How worried are you, given what happened in Genoa, that they actually killed a young man, that the state is going to increasingly meet resistance like this with force?
I think that what happened in Genoa was the responsibility of the Italian government and then the Italian police. And so that's why this is not going to stop our movement. But we know that when our movement is becoming bigger and bigger, the response in front of the police is also going to be higher. And so we have to be careful about that.
Some people are saying that with next year's presidential elections coming up, that you stand a good chance of mobilizing people. How interested are you in such a role?
I'm not interested by that kind of proposition. We are building a social movement, an international movement, to have more international rights for the people. That's our fight. It's not a political fight inside of a country only.
What began as a protest action by some 300 farmers has now spiraled into a much vaster movement, bringing in people from different sectors. Demands now include maintaining social spending and public investment in rural France, as well as forging a common platform with labor unions, consumer rights groups, and civil society as a whole. The Mio McDonald's has a whole new dimension today. Guy Holstein.
L'action du McDo a une résonance particulièrement importante.
The McDonald's event has international significance today. We began our struggle against what we felt was a symbol of U.S. imperialism and neoliberal globalization. I hope that in 10 years, this symbol will become a museum, and that after our victory, people will visit the Milo McDonald's and see it as a bad memory of the past.
I'm Sputnik Kilambi in Mio for Free Speech Radio News.
A newly released report points to Canadian mining company Cambior as the source of health problems for residents of the South American country Guyana who live near the Essequibo River. The report, by an environmental group in the Netherlands, looked at the Omai gold mine in Guyana. Montreal-based Cambior is a 65% owner of Omai Gold Mines Limited. The gold mine uses cyanide and arsenic in its refinement process, then dumps it into the Essequibo River, the report alleges. The environmental report is the latest salvo by area residents in an effort to hold the company responsible for a 1995 accident at the mine in which 2.3 billion liters of cyanide-laced waste spilled into the river. They filed a $100 million class action lawsuit alleging devastating results from the spill. The outcome of this case could change how Canadian mining companies operate abroad. Stephen Cooperman reports from Montreal.
It's been 6 years since 2.3 billion liters of cyanide-laced waste spilled into the Essequibo River from the Omai gold mine in Guyana. But the effects of the spill are still being felt, both on the medical and legal fronts. Residents near the river blame the spill for a host of new medical ailments, and Cambior, the parent company of Omai Gold Mines Limited, continues to defend itself in court against charges by American attorney Denison Smith, who's representing 23,000 residents of Guyana. He was just in Montreal to present the findings of the newest report holding Cambior responsible for the devastation that has ensued since the spill. Robert Lavalliere is the industrial relations manager of Cambior. He says Smith is engaging in a continuing smear campaign of the company in order to drum up public support for the residents and in the hope of an eventual cash settlement with the company.
He's put some pressure on the company just to buy the piece on it.
While the legal proceedings wind through the courts, mining continues at the Omai gold mine. In 1996, a commission of inquiry by the Guyanese government found that at no time was the contaminated water a serious threat to life. It then gave the company the go-ahead to continue mining at the Omai mine. Smith has contested the validity of the original findings, saying they were inaccurate. He says the Guyanese government bent to the will of the company.
Cambior basically wrote its own environmental laws, got the government to approve it. And those laws are wholly inadequate to the situation environment you find in Guyana.
He also contests any claims by the company about the continued safety of their mining practices.
Cambior talks about North American standards. Take Canada, for example. These standards are based on environments which are in many ways subarctic in nature. In Guyana, you have a tropical environment. And actually, this is one of the main reasons why you've had so many problems in environmental management, is because they have not taken into account the local conditions of Guyana.
As for how the company has allegedly been able to manipulate the government, even in the court proceedings, Smith points to the economics of the situation. The Omai mine is the second largest mine in Guyana. It employs about 2,000 people. It also accounts for about 20% of the country's export earnings. Joan Kuyek is with the nonprofit mining watchdog group Mining Watch Canada, and she echoes Smith on the matter.
The court system in most countries is very weak, and is they preserve the powerful, always has been. And in countries where the power elite are dependent upon the mine for money, they're not going to have very much interest in having citizens from peasant communities and indigenous communities make a case against the company.
With this in mind, Smith tried to file against the company in a Quebec court where Cambior has its head office. The court said it was outside its jurisdiction to rule on the case and referred the case back to Guyana. Smith says an appeal to the Quebec court is in the works. For now, the case is slated to be heard in Guyana in September. As for whether Cambior will respect the decision of the Guyanese court, company spokesperson Lavalliere had this to say.
We will see.
Stephen Cooperman, Free Speech Radio News, Montreal, Canada.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Laura Flanders. Please tune in again tomorrow.